And welcome to New Books in Philosophy, a podcast channel with the New Books Network. I'm Carrie Figdor, Associate Professor of Philosophy at the University of Iowa, and I'm co-host of the channel along with Robert Talese, Professor of Philosophy at Vanderbilt University. Together, we bring you conversations with philosophers about their new books, drawing from a wide range of areas of contemporary philosophical inquiry. Today's interview is with Colin Klein, lecturer in the Department of Philosophy at Macquarie University in Australia. His new book, What the Body Commands, The Imperative Theory of Pain, is just out from the MIT Press. Nothing seems so obviously true as the claim that pains feel bad, that they are painful, that pain and suffering go together. And yet, argues Klein, pain and suffering can come apart, and we need an account of pain that can explain why. On the imperative theory of pain, a pain is a protective imperative whose content is to protect the body or body part. For example, don't put weight on that left ankle. In this accessible yet vigorous defense of the imperative theory, Klein argues that pains do not represent the causes of pain, do not inform us about tissue damage, and should not be identified with the painful sensations. He shows us how his account is sufficient to distinguish pain locations, qualities, and intensities, and he deals with cases in which people report feeling pain, but not being the least bit motivated to do anything about it. He also considers the problem of masochistic pleasure, where we seek to act in ways that do not protect the body. And finally, he addresses the question, why do pains hurt? Let's turn to the interview. Hello, Colin Klein. Are you there?
I am. Hi, Carrie.
Hi. Nice to talk with you, and welcome to New Books in Philosophy.
Hey, thanks. I'm delighted to be here.
This is a great book. It was a wonderful read. Very easy to read, easy to follow, and well argued, and also, you know, obviously a bit contentious in certain ways. So I'm looking forward to talking about it with you. Before we get to the actual imperative theory of pain, which you're defending in the book, can you tell us a bit about yourself, how you came to philosophy, how you came to this area of research, and how you came to write this particular book?
Sure. So how I got to philosophy, I've always been interested in the mind. I think the mind is still the last great mystery to be solved. When I was an undergraduate, I was at Franklin and Marshall College in Pennsylvania, and I had a great opportunity where I majored both in philosophy and in an interdisciplinary program they had called Scientific and Philosophical Studies of Mind. And that let me do both a lot of philosophy and also empirically oriented work. As for pain, when I was about 13, I broke my ankle very badly in wrestling practice. And so that's also given me a lot of good examples over the years, and that's why the book focuses so much on ankle pain. But when I was in the hospital, they gave me morphine, and I had an experience, which turns out to be quite common, where I was laying there, my ankle, as far as I can tell, still hurt, but I didn't care about it anymore. I was, as I sort of described it, I was up here, it was down there. I didn't know what one had to do with the other. And I didn't think about that much until I had a philosophy class, and Daniel Dennett actually talks about this in, I believe, Why You Can't Make a Computer That Feels Pain. And so I talked to my philosophy advisor at the time, Bennett Helm, who had also written a lot on pain, and that's kind of how the interest started, and I've just been sort of thinking about it and writing about it ever since.
Okay, so this book kind of brings together, you know, you have published a number of previous papers, but this kind of brings it all together and provides a more thorough defense of the theory and elaboration of the theory as well. So you divide What the Body Commands into roughly three parts. First, you establish a sort of general framework that you call homeostatic sensations of the body and the general idea of imperatives and imperative content. You also distinguish pain from suffering, which is one of the features of your account that many philosophers, at least, will find both interesting and perhaps surprising and to some extent counterintuitive. Then you go into, you know, how to elaborate the imperative theory and show how it can give you know, it has the resources to distinguish different sorts of pains, you know, their intensities, their qualities, and so forth. And then, you know, you address a number of very interesting objections, including the sort of case you just mentioned, the morphine pain, where somebody, you know, has this feeling, as you described it, the pain's down there and I'm up here and, you know, I could care less, which is certainly, you know, counterintuitive for most pains. And you also, of course, discuss masochistic pain. Or pleasure, I should say. So let's start with the general picture, just to lay the framework for an imperative theory, you know, homeostatic sensations and imperatives in general. You could say something about that?
Yeah, sure. So just as sort of more general background to start off with, the picture in the book, the sort of main claim, imperativism, is the idea that pains have a content, but that content is something like a command rather than, say, a representation of the world. So the pain of a sprained ankle says something like, don't put weight on this ankle. So that's what I'm trying to defend in the book. And I actually think pains are not the only things with imperative content. I actually think it applies to this whole class of bodily sensations that I start by marking off as what I call the homeostatic sensations. So, as you mentioned, these are the sensations whose function is to kind of maintain bodily parameters within some range. Now, sometimes your body can do that on its own, as it were, without any help, right? So there are a lot of kind of internal ion concentrations and things like this that they go on all the time. You're not aware of them, and in part because there's nothing you can really do about them. But there are many things, like, so suppose your fluid levels drop, so you don't have enough water. Your body can do some things with that. It can, you know, stop sweating and so on. But really, it needs you to take action. So you need to go get more water. And so what I think happens in the way the body solves this problem is there are sensations like thirst, and the content of something like thirst is a command, go drink water. If you follow that command, then under ordinary circumstances, and that's always an important proviso, then under ordinary circumstances, you'll solve the problem that gave rise to the sensation in the first place. So that's what's going on with homeostatic sensations. And then what I want to do is identify pain as one of those homeostatic sensations. And that's why we ought to also think about it as an imperative.
Okay, so one of the things that occurred to me as I was reading was, you know, a lot of your examples of these commands were, you know, don't put weight on that ankle. And I kept thinking, would it have been better to maybe think instead of, you know, commanding to do something, to take action, which is, you know, sort of how you describe it most generally, I was thinking maybe, you know, why wouldn't you instead characterize it in terms of, you know, inhibiting, particularly given the emphasis that you give on recuperation and the role of pain, the recovery period, rather than, you know, we as philosophers, at least, and certainly other, you know, clinical people thinking about pain, we think about the moment at which we start to feel it rather than the whole period of recuperation. And one of the things that you correctly emphasize is that this command of pain is, you know, don't do stuff that's going to prevent or make the recovery worse or something along those lines. So these are sorts of omissions rather than actions. And so my general question was just, why not think of pain then in terms of inhibiting rather than, you know, telling you to do something, you know, telling you don't do something?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So as a bit of background, and as you say, it's quite right, I want to focus in the book on the role of pain and recuperation. And I was really inspired in this by part by the work of Patrick Wall, who's one of the two big names in pain science in the 20th century. And he emphasizes a lot that role of pain, you know, in keeping you resting, keeping you from re-injuring yourself or from using body parts that are sort of healed but still weak, that sort of thing. And he actually, his picture is very much a kind of, almost as you describe, a kind of inhibitory one. So he thinks that's the primary role of pain. And I like that, and I think that's very important. And, you know, I argue in the book that that recuperation phase made this sort of primary biological importance of pain. And in earlier versions in defending the imperative theory, so for example, my 2007 paper, I actually did put in terms of what I called prescription commands. So it's commands that rule out certain kinds of movement. I did that for a couple reasons. Partly, I thought I needed it to solve the problem of pain asymbolia, which we may talk about a bit later, or morphine pain at the time. But I think it's a very relatively clean way to do it. Unfortunately, there are a lot of counter or what appear to be counterexamples that, you know, I had a story about, but I think putting in terms of positive protection makes for a cleaner story. So Maura Tumulty, I think, was the first person to really call my attention to a lot of these. So particularly visceral pain, so menstrual cramps or kidney stones. Sometimes these are parts of your body where you don't have any voluntary control over them. So it's hard to see what the command, don't do something with this, could do. I did have a story about that, but I think it's protection is cleaner for a lot of those. The other problem, I mean, sometimes, you know, Newton had his apple and I, you know, ran into the corner of a table with my testicles one night going to the kitchen. And, you know, as one does, doubled over, and there's sort of particular guarding motion that people should be familiar with. And reflecting upon that in the light of day, I thought, well, there are actually a lot of things that seem like adaptive things to do with pain that do involve some more positive motion. So particularly those guarding motions. So it's not just that, so take a cut or something. It's not just that I don't bang the cut on the wall or something, but I also tend to, you know, if I see something come close to it, I'll also, you know, put my hand to protect it and so on. And so I wanted something that would capture that broader sense where you may have some positive motions that will also protect the affected area. So that's why I moved more towards this kind of positive imperative towards to protect. Although in the majority of cases, what protection will involve will be largely a lack of use or a lack of motion.
Okay. And then I think, you know, one of the more contentious things I want to get to is the distinction to draw, obviously, because you're giving a pure imperative theory. So the content of a pain is this command, you know, protective, imperative, and the painfulness of pain becomes something contingent. And that's, you know, philosophically, that's a very, very contentious thesis. But before we get to that issue momentarily, you also briefly sort of distinguish your imperative account from a much more maybe philosophically common, I don't know, outside of philosophy, but just the idea that, well, what pains do is to inform us of tissue damage. So it's a more, I think you use the term representationalist. You don't dwell on other accounts so much, but it might be helpful for you to, you know, say something about this, you know, at least intuitive alternative, one that's been around in a sense, that it's that the if pain has a function, the function is to inform us of tissue damage rather than command us to do something.
Yeah, right. So I think that is a common view. And I think that's also, you know, it's something I hear from ordinary people as well, the idea that what, you know, just as visual sensations are there to inform us about the visual world, things like pain are there to inform us about facts about our body. And what they inform us about is that something's cut or hurt or damaged or disturbed or something like that. So in philosophy, this is often associated with representationalism, although there are many ways in which a pain might represent damage, so that's a kind of big tent. I do think that's wrong, and actually, you know, arguing against that, I should say one of the features of the book is my main goal was to present imperativism as an attractive and coherent picture, especially since people often think that it's attractive but not coherent. So some of it is a sort of, a lot of it is defense. And so I don't do, in the book, a ton of the really detailed discussion of other positions other than to explain why mine is better. So it's a very, like, it's a polemical book in that sense. But I do talk a fair bit about representationalism because I think that's probably the going position, at least if you want to be a naturalist, as I do, ultimately about something like pain sensations. So representationalism, I have a few considerations in the book about this. One, I think it's actually, when you start thinking about the sort of pains you have, it turns out pains are not nearly as informative as we would like them to be. So even though I hurt, so for example, an example I use a lot, I do a lot of weightlifting, and the next day I'm often genuinely confused. I'm always sore, but I can be genuinely confused about whether it's ordinary post-exercise pain or whether I've actually hurt something. I don't know, and in some sense, and this is the sort of intuition that imperativist theory is supposed to capture, in some sense it actually doesn't matter at all what's going on, right? All it matters in terms of my body is that I rest and don't use that muscle so that, you know, whatever's wrong can fix itself. So I think pains tend to be not particularly informative. And of course, they are very sort of directly and obviously motivating. And so that's a reason. And that's a disanalogy with, say, visual sensations that many people have noted as an obstacle for representationalism generally. So imperativism wants to say, yeah, look, pains very much are very dislike representations. They motivate us, they don't inform, but that's precisely what imperatives do. And so that's why we should move to imperative content.
Okay. So to pick up on the comment on directly motivating, this does give me a way to raise the issue which I mentioned just before about the contentiousness of the imperative theory in the sense of distinguishing between pain and painfulness or suffering. You have two chapters. You address the issue, you know, at different parts of the book. So it's obviously something that is very important to address. Could you say something first, just to lay the groundwork of our discussion, how you see the relationship between pain and painfulness? And let me be specific about two sort of sub questions. Is it would seem, I mean, that first of all, intuitively, from a philosophical point of view, many philosophers identify pain with the painful feeling. And this, of course, reverberates in a lot of different ways in philosophy of mind. Making that sort of distinction is immediately going to be contentious. But there's also what you just mentioned in terms of the directly motivating from an intuitive point of view, not necessarily a philosophical point of view, but certainly intuitively, the painfulness seems to motivate you. I mean, that's what got you to, you know, respond when you, you know, hit a soft body part against a table. That's what got you doing what you're doing, or at least that's the way it seems. And on your view, there has to be some sort of difference between the painfulness and then the pain, which is motivating you, if these are only contingently, you know, related. Okay, mm-hmm. So if you could, you know, kind of address that ball of questions about the relationship between those two.
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, and as you rightly say, and I put it in the book, I want to make this distinction between pain, or what we sometimes call, when we want to mark it off in English, I think, we'll sometimes say physical pain. Not in the sort of philosopher sense of physicalist, but just, you know, ordinary folk will say, well, it's, you know, physical pain as contrasted with emotional pain, say. And then there's this, what I call suffering or hurt or painfulness, or in general, that, you know, this fact that pains feel bad, which, as you rightly point out, I mean, many people have thought is the kind of the definitive thing about pains. That's why we don't like pains. That's why, you know, that's the role pain plays in ethics and so forth. Now, I do think, so I spend a lot of time on the book because, on the one hand, I do think there's an important distinction between the two, and I'll talk about that in a second. I also think that the imperative has to say that there's an important distinction between the two. And this came, you know, originally this came as, I think, an objection that people would bring up to imperativism that I've now embraced as a virtue. So, because the idea is, take some of the other, what I think of as imperative sensations. So all these bodily sensations like hunger or thirst or the need, you know, the need to breathe, something like that. Mild hunger, I think, does not feel particularly bad. It's not, it's certainly not painful. It doesn't make you suffer. You might not want to have it more than you want to have it, but it's not a bad feeling in that sense. And well, that'll confuse it. I mean, sometimes it might even be a pleasant feeling, but in any case, you know, if hunger is an imperative, then it seems like imperatives don't necessarily feel bad. So there's a question. Why is it that pains do? And I think, and I argue in the book that, of course, although most pains feel bad, in fact, that's a contingent relationship. So I think this is something that the imperativist has to say. But I also think there's good independent reason to adopt the distinction. So get this distinction between, you know, and what I'll call, in this context, physical pain, which is what the book is about. So the pain that you get when you drop a brick on your toe or something like that. And what's sometimes called hurt or suffering or something like that, which I conceive of as a second-order sensation that can qualify a huge variety of different first-order mental states. So it can qualify pains, but it can also qualify... So, for example, you can be painfully hungry, painfully tired. It's often attaches to emotions, and people do often ask me about emotional pain. So you can be painfully lonely, you can be painfully heartbroken. Grief is a paradigmatically painful emotion. I think there are probably, you know, aesthetic pains of watching a particularly bad movie or looking at a particularly ugly painting or something like that. So I think it's actually quite wide what something like hurt or painfulness or suffering. I use all these kind of interchangeably. It's quite wide what these qualify. I think pains mostly feel painful, and that's kind of where the name comes from. And as R.M. Hare points out, he's got a nice discussion of this distinction from the 60s, ordinary English is in many ways ambiguous, which is no surprise, between, you know, the word pain can refer to any of these or the conglomeration depending. But I think it's worth separating them out. So I have a couple of arguments in the book about this. Here are, I think, the two most useful ones. One is just this dissociation argument. So I think on the one hand, there are painful things that aren't physical pain. So I just mentioned a bunch of those. Emotional pains and so on. I also think that there are ordinary pains that aren't particularly painful. People tend not to be aware of these, but, you know, unless their attention is called to them, precisely because you don't suffer from them, you tend not to think about them very much. So I think unproblematic postural adjustments are the easiest one. So often when you're sitting, and this is actually a very important function of the pain system, when you're sitting, you know, you feel a little bit of pain, you shift your position, it goes away, it's fine. If you don't do that, if you're in a situation where you can't do it, it becomes very painful and ultimately very bad for you. But ordinarily, these are these kind of small minor pains that come and go, and I think they're kind of the equivalent of mild hunger. They're pain, and they still motivate you, but they don't feel particularly bad, and you don't suffer from them. There are pathological cases as well, but I wanted to try to come up with some non-pathological ones in the book. So I think there's good evidence that they come apart. And I also think, and this is kind of important for the argument, I think they motivate different things. So I think, as I, you know, argued in the first part, physical pain, what it does is it motivates you to protect a body part from certain kinds of harms in order that it might, you know, in order to preserve bodily integrity. Painfulness, on the other hand, and considered as this kind of second order state, I think has as its object the first order sensation and tells you something like, get rid of that first order sensation. And these can come apart. So take in the book, I talk about something like being painfully lonely. So you might think that being painfully lonely, there are actually two sets of motivations and they can cross cut each other. So if I'm lonely, what that motivates me to do, let's suppose, is go out and make friends. You know, I can go out to the pub, I can join a sports team, whatever. That's what the loneliness motivates me to do. But being painfully lonely motivates me to do things to get rid of the feeling of loneliness. And some of those things won't be things that solve loneliness. Some of those things might be, for example, drinking alone in my room or joining the French Foreign Legion or spending hours on the internet to distract myself. If I do those things, I might, you know, as it were, push away the feeling of loneliness But I don't solve the problem that loneliness is pushing me to solve. So I think you get two different kinds of motivations there, one towards the mental state and one, as it were, pushing you towards the world, that can be at cross purposes. And I think you actually see this with pain as well. So I think there's the first order motivation of pain, which motivates you to protect a body part. And then there's this feeling of painfulness, which motivates you to get rid of that first order sensation. Now, you can get rid of the sensation. And I think this is really pressing because, you know, especially with pains of recuperation, they can be there for quite a long time. So although you're, you know, doing what the pain tells you, that doesn't make the pain go away. And that's important because the pain has to be kind of forward looking. So you have to, you know, you have to stay off a broken ankle, not just in the instant, but you also can't plan to do things with it and so on.
Right.
So the pain motivates you to do things with the broken ankle. Painfulness might motivate me, for example, to take an ibuprofen or to take some morphine or, you know, I've heard get a cortisone shot or something. And in some cases, those can actually be bad. This can work at cross purposes, right? So if I get a shot of morphine, I might be more likely to walk on the ankle because, you know, I don't feel anything anymore. Cortisone shots, I've heard, can be sort of bad in the long run because although they reduce the inflammation, they don't. You know, there's something about the kind of damage to the underlying stuff. So in any case, you get these two kinds of motivations that are, you know, although they can coincide in many cases, they're at enough of cross purposes that I think it's worth separating them out.
So let me just kind of push back on behalf of the, you know, person who thinks that they shouldn't be distinguished in this way.
Mm-hmm.
So you said earlier that, you know, you kind of talk about hurt and painfulness and suffering, and you kind of use those interchangeably. And, you know, so the pushback might be people say, well, wait a minute there. It seems to me that maybe you're in some sense equivocating. You know, when we talk about something being painful, you know, we're thinking obviously paradigmatically about physical pain, you know, that really, you know, of which there are various types, but it's that thing that causes you to not step on the ankle and mm-hmm. you know, protect your testicles and so forth, or bend over. And so if you call that like a second order, you know, motivation to get rid of the sensation, somebody who thinks along these lines would say, well, that is the pain that you are trying to get rid of it. And if you're like calling the pain something else, you're equivocating in some sense on what we mean by pain or something along those lines. And to kind of press the point, if I have a thought, you know, I once had an accident. Somebody knocked me over in a ultimate frisbee game, very very badly, and I landed, you know, straight on my stomach, with my arm underneath me, and broke the arm, and it was painful. But you know, so now of course I don't play ultimate frisbee for this very reason, because it's like, you know, some people just don't understand when it's a friendly game, and when it's, you know, akin to football. And so I have thoughts that, you know, don't play frisbee, you know, because I'm protecting my body. And and on your view, it seems like that thought will be, since it has the imperative content to protect my body, that is going to count as a pain on your imperative account. But there's obviously nothing, as we would normally say, painful about it, about that thought. And so the idea is, well, if you're identifying the pain with that imperative content or that state of with that has that imperative content, you've kind of just, you know, you've changed the subject in some way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So let me see. There are two things there. Let me see if I can address everything. So on the first one, I mean, you know, again, I appeal to R.M. Harris's discussion of this about ambiguity, but you're right. And this is the sort of problem that, or, you know, the sort of fight you can have in philosophy where you say, look, you say it's ambiguous. I say you're just ducking the question.
Right.
So I mean, there are a few that, you know, I do address this more in the book, and there are a few things. One is, I really think you know, this story about pain that links it up with the other homeostatic sensations is for me one of the attractive bits of it. So that, because it does seem to me that biologically speaking, pain really does have this important role that links it up with hunger and thirst and so on. And it's not just the sort of phenomenology of it. There's a lot of good anatomical evidence. So one of the people I talk about some of the book, the sort of current pain scientist A.D. Craig, has done a lot of nice work on this. So I think that, you know, that's an independent reason to like it. I also think, so I talk about this, you know, Christine Korsgaard, who's far smarter than I am, you know, has this discussion about, well, you know, I think has your intuitions on this, and has this discussion about, well, what do pains have in common? What could the, you know, the pain of dropping a brick on your foot, I can't remember what example is, and heartbreak and so on all have in common. And she ends up very skeptical that there is anything that they could have in common, except maybe, you know, something like the feel. I mean, she goes back and forth on this. So it's a very nice discussion. But in general, people who haven't made this distinction between, you know, physical pain and painfulness, when they go through and try to say, well, okay, what's common to all of these things lumped together, they have a very hard time spelling that out. So it becomes a philosophically very complicated and tangential position. I think it's Adam Swenson has a nice discussion of this. There's a similar problem with pleasure as well. So... So I think, whereas if you separate the two out, I think you get a very nice clean picture on both ends. So that's a kind of philosophical advantage. Now, as for this question about the contents, I should say sort of, although I'm always glossing the contents with ordinary English sentences, like don't put weight on that foot, presumably, you know, obviously these are not going to be, well, maybe not obviously, they're not going to be English sentences. And in fact, I take it in the book, you know, when I spell out the sort of more formal conditions for the imperatives, they're going to be quite a bit more complicated and they have a fair bit of internal structure. Now, there are two things to say there. I mean, just as a bit of background here. So let me give you the quick answer, which may not be satisfying, and then the background, which may not make it any more satisfying, but at least explain why I'm saying it. The quick answer is the sort of ordinary language thought that you have when you think, oh, gee, I should protect my arm by not playing Ultimate anymore. And just say tangentially, by the way, one of the things about working on pain is I believe I've now heard more broken arm and broken leg stories than any other philosopher. But in any case, one of the things you get out of this, or sorry, the ordinary English sentence in your head, I take it, is going to have very roughly similar content, but in fact, the content of your pain is going to be quite specific and quite complex. And of course, you know, that's why there's a phenomenological difference. So, in the background here, at least the way I set it up in the book, I'm tempted by the philosophical position known as intentionalism, which says something like, in the weak form, phenomenal properties supervene on intentional properties, or supervene on the contents, intentional contents. The reason why that's attractive is if you've got naturalist leanings and you think that content can then be further reduced, can be part of some naturalist reduction, then you've got a story about how you move from phenomenology down to something naturalistically respectable. I would like that to be true. That's, as far as I can tell, the easiest way to do it if it works. Pains are one of the sort of traditional objections to intentionalism. For some of the reasons I mentioned before, it seems like they have very different qualities. And so my original work on this was to say, look, one of the ways you can defend intentionalism, if you're so inclined, is to say pains have a content, but let's distinguish the type of content and say, look, there's imperative content that does some of these and you know, indicative content that does the rest. Now, there's this bigger question in the background with intentionalism of something like, well, why is it that having content at all is sufficient for, you know, being aware at all? Do you need something more to this? Is it the type of content? These are big questions, and in some sense, they are they're questions that I intentionally dodge in the book because it's not a book about consciousness. I think if I had that story, I would be... Yeah, I would be making more money and be more famous than I am. So I've been trying to focus in on this more specific question. Well, what is it that, you know, distinguishes pain from other sensations? What is it that distinguishes different types of pains from each other? And, you know, I think that's, if you're going at the book looking for a theory of consciousness generally, or a sort of the thing that will convince you of intentionalism where you weren't convinced before, you're likely to be a bit disappointed. But on the other hand, I think, fully, if you want to defend something like intentionalism, the thing to do, as in fact many people do, is to go through and think more carefully and in this sort of detailed way about what the contents are and what their structures are and so forth, and how that can capture a lot of the variation within pain, you know, within and between pains. And so that's the sort of thing that I'm trying to do. Whereas, you know, your thought, there's some surely some further story about why your thought, I should not play Ultimate Frisbee because I should protect my arm. Well, that has a sort of cognitive phenomenology rather than a sensory phenomenology and so on. But that starts getting to things that hopefully someone smarter than me will take up and solve.
So, okay, well, I mean, you're kind of pressing on this. I do want to get to the various intricacies of the content, which you give have a couple of nice chapters on the variations there. You know, two things that talk of pain in philosophical circles, of course, you know, one is C fibers, which you don't talk about, you know, very much. So you might mention something about, you know, the role of C fibers in your account of pain. But also because the painfulness, you know, is, and maybe this talks to the comment you just made about consciousness. It's also part of a traditional argument against, you know, some kind of materialist view of the mind, right? I mean, you know, for some sort of dualism is, you know, we can imagine creatures that that have C fibers, or I can imagine, you know, having pains and not having C fibers, right? That's kind of where the C fibers tend to play a polemical role. Can you say something? You don't go into this much or you know, hardly at all in the book. You know, as you just said, you don't. It's more just let's lay out the theory of an imperative theory, and I will dodge these bullets for the time being. But I think, at least for our audiences who are listening, these are the questions that are going to be pressing, you know. So I think it would be a good idea to say something about C fibers and the role of pain in philosophical argument in terms of, you know, arguments, you know, for dualism or against some sort of materialist view.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think in terms of conceivability arguments, I mean, again, although this is not something I'll defend now or in the book, I'm on the side where I think, you know, conceivability arguments tend to be a relatively poor guide to possibility. And one of the reasons why they tend to be a relatively poor guide to possibility is because the empirical world is very complicated and we can often, you know, so ideal conceivability, I have no idea about, but when we in fact sit around in our proverbial armchairs and try to conceive of things, we often go astray in part because things like pain are very complicated phenomena. There are a lot of things that go on. There's a lot of variation. There's sort of a lot of, you know, interesting and subtle empirical facts about pain that, you know, we, of course, we can become aware of, but we don't know. And all of those are things that mess up our intuitions about conceivability. So I think, you know, one of the things that I'm trying to do in the book is to say, look, here are these, you know, and I'm not the first to do this. I mean, a lot of philosophers have done this, so I'm continuing the tradition of saying, actually, look, pain is a very complicated phenomena. It's not this kind of simple qualia that you can rearrange freely in your mind. So that's, you know, I think I do take the book to be contributing towards that sort of project. In terms of C fibers, this will more be ranting, because I say, you know, everyone who works on pain knows this and is sort of frustrated by it. C fibers firing, which was either Place or Smart who used it, and even they pointed out, oh, well, this is not right, but it's a useful placeholder, and so it's kind of become this shibboleth. C fibers are peripheral fibers. So, you know, they're the ones that take information to the spinal cord. So they're not even in your brain. It's like saying vision is the optic nerve firing. But it's not, you know, you might think, well, it's just a placeholder or whatever. But I think it's actually even, there's an even more important flaw there. And here, again, I'm guided by the kind of two big names in 20th century pain, Wall and Ronald Melzack, who spent a lot of time on this, there's still this kind of idea, what used to be called a specificity theory or the labeled lines theory, that you know, you've got pain receptors down in the skin. There's a single kind of pain fiber that carries it up to the brain. And let's say, you know, there's a pain area that lights up when you feel pain. And I think that kind of empirical picture, the sort of naive empirical picture that a lot of people have, is one of the things that contributes to this feeling that, you know, conceivability, you know, these conceivability arguments. Mm-hmm. But in fact, the pain system is extremely complex. So in addition to C fibers, you have A delta fibers, which carry different sorts of information about damage. But there are also a lot of others, so touch fibers, or the, you know, some of the A beta fibers and some of these things that carry information that we normally think of as touch information also modulate pain. And as you go up, it just gets more and more complex. There's also, it doesn't seem like any particular single pain area in the brain. So pain itself is a very complicated and very integrative system. So it takes in a lot of information, both about what's happening in the body, but also in your current state, and puts that together into the sensation. So this is Melzack sometimes called a neuromatrix theory rather than a labeled lines theory. And I think once you start thinking about pain in this more complicated way, that pushes you towards at least a more sort of empirically realistic view that your philosophical thesis is going to have to account for. So that, I'm not sure if that entirely gets it, but that's sort of some of the things that are going on.
Okay. So let's get to the content. You mentioned, you know, obviously the fact that you use English language sentences to express the content. The imperative content is not really, you know, that's kind of a shibboleth in a way. So the real schema, right, if, you know, again, this is just expressing the schema, is sort of, you know, keep body part, you know, such and such from this action with some, you know, degree of priority. Mm-hmm. And this is just the general bottom line schema. And part of your pure imperativist account, as you put it, is that you claim that this simple schema, you know, with can handle all the different parameters or different types of pain that that we encounter. So differences in the qualities of pain, their location, differences in the intensity. Can you say something about this general schema for the protection imperative that is
pain? Yeah. So, yeah, as you mentioned, one of the things, you know, in the book, I'm defending what I call pure imperativism, where you've only got the imperative content. There are a few other people who like some imperative content. So Richard Hall and Manolo Martinez have both defended this, but also have some kind of sensory or indicative content. So you have a kind of hybrid content. And in some ways, that's much easier because you can say all of the things that the representationalists say. So, you know, you can locate pain where the damage is or whatever. Imperatives are much harder. So what I do when I kind of spell out the details of the content, and this goes over, you know, this is all very quick because this goes over a few chapters, is talk about things like, so I want the schema to have at least three slots that can vary to account for the three kinds of variation that I see in pain. So where your pain is, how it feels, whether it's a sort of throbbing pain or a stabbing pain or a stinging pain, and the intensity of the pain. So intensity actually hasn't been talked about a lot. I rely on that rely on work that I've done there with my collaborator Manolo Martinez about trying to link that up to sort of variations in urgency of ordinary language imperatives. Because although, you know, I said before, you know, it's important that these aren't the same thing that's expressed by ordinary language imperatives. But that said, I think one of the exciting things about imperativism for me is that there is a lot of work in linguistics and philosophy on the properties of imperatives. And by focusing on that, so it's more than just an analogy, by focusing on some of these properties of commands expressed by imperatives, you can find a lot of interest, you can shed light on a lot of interesting things about pain. So, you know, we rely on that work for intensity. I talk about how the location varies with the body part that needs to be protected, and then the sort of qualities of pain, so things like burning, stabbing, and so on. What I argue in the book is that that should correspond to variations in what you ought to do with respect to that body part. So sometimes, you know, sometimes people have this intuition like, well, a stabbing pain or a burning pain represents the kind of thing that would happen when you get burned. And if you look at the empirical literature, it's actually very interesting. So, like, you know, people report that stabs tend to be a burning pain. Broken things are often stabbing pains and so on. So these descriptors don't line up very well with the type of damage. And I argue in the book that that's probably, there's better evidence that they line up with the kind of protection you ought to do. So that's, you know, that's the sort of, I think the bulk of the more technical part of the book is going through these and trying to spell out that that content in detail and why we should expect that content to give you the variations in different types of pain.
Okay. So one of the things that does come up and has come up in our discussion is this idea that I think you mentioned it before, pain asymbolia or morphine pain, where we aren't motivated to protect the body part. So when you turn to counterexamples to the theory, I mean, these are sort of obvious counterexamples of cases where one would say, this person has a pain, but they are not at all motivated to do anything to protect themselves. And that just seems to be a straight out, you know, counterexample falsification of the theory. And there's also, how do you deal with the cases of morphine pain and pain asymbolia?
Yeah, so I think it's right. You know, I think these are the really pressing kinds of cases because these seem to be ones. So with morphine pain, you know, as I was sort of describing with my broken ankle, you know, there, it's not just that it doesn't hurt anymore. So it's not just that you don't have this sort of what I think is the higher order thing, but it actually seems like people in these states aren't motivated to protect the body part either. And pain asymbolia, which is a sort of rare consequence of brain damage, you do get accounts of patients who will sort of happily let themselves be poked and burned and so on. It's obviously kind of dangerous to be that sort of person. But they will say that they feel pain. So it seems like those are pains that don't motivate any protective action or really anything at all. And that does seem like a very strong counterexample. So the story I tell in the book goes something like this. So in any case, you know, we probably won't get a chance to talk about this much, but I talk about commands are always motivating against this background condition of accepting an authority. So accepting the source of commands as an authority. And I argue in the book that we accept our body as a source of commands and as an authority, and we do so because we care about our body. So I think there is a way for the imperativist to respond, which is to say, well, look, in these cases, what you have is a breakdown of the authority of the body because, you know, I claim this, this is still the, many of us are fighting about this now, but there's a breakdown in authority because you no longer care about your body. And I think what happens when you go and you actually look at the clinical literature on pain asymbolia, this is what impressed me, it turns out that their patients seem indifferent to pain. They're also quite indifferent to any other threats to their body, or so it seems. So they're indifferent to loud noises. They're indifferent to people swinging hammers at them and lighting off flares in front of them. This was 1920s in Austria, where, you know, long before institutional review boards. So, and you know, and the original patient, they've done this. She wasn't just affectively flat. So there's an amazing bit where they start telling her that she's a liar and a thief, and she gets very angry and indignant. So she feels emotions and she feels motivated. It just seems like she doesn't really care what happens to her body anymore. And I think if you can get to that state, which, you know, for very good reasons, we ordinarily can't just think ourselves into it, then you would have pains that cease to be motivating, and they would have the status of, there's still pains because you, they're commands, but they're commands that come from a source that you no longer care about. So that's a kind of a complication of the picture, but sort of, I think that actually captures these things. So certainly, you know, I talked a bit about my experience with morphine pain, and I'm obviously I'm biased here, but the feeling was something like, yeah, there's pain, it's down there, and, you know, it's shouting at me and I don't care anymore. Like, it can do what it wants because it's down there. I don't see why I should care. Of course, I didn't care about much of all. This is, right, the kind of dangerous thing about morphine as a drug is all I want to do is just lay around and watch cartoons. Maybe that.
Yeah.
And if the cartoons went off, probably wouldn't have cared. So, but the important claim, and this is now ends up being an empirical claim in the book, is that you're only going to get indifference to pain in these cases where you have a fairly radical breakdown sort of with the relationship to the body. So this kind of strong dissociative phenomena are places where you will find this. You're not going to have it with anything less. So that it does make, although it's sort of crafted to defend imperativism, I do think it actually has, you know, reasonably strong and testable consequences.
Okay, well, that there's sort of two linked questions in response. I'm thinking about leprosy. I've been to a leper colony, and I, you know, lepers don't, you know, the reason why they lose their fingers is just because they don't feel, and it they just, you know, it they repeatedly injure them and aren't just don't feel it, aren't aware of it. I wouldn't say that that lepers don't care about their bodies. So they're not getting the imperative in any way. There's something wrong, obviously, mm-hmm. but it doesn't seem to be that the authority of the authority of their body has been lost to them, mm-hmm. That they don't care about it. And this is not a matter of affective flatness overall. It's just that doesn't seem to characterize what's going on in leprosy. But then there's also the case, well, you know, how about the leper or somebody who compensates for the fact that they don't, you know, have some sort of normal the pain does not have its what otherwise would be its normal motivating force, but instead, in the case of leprosy or maybe some other things, you use visual information mm-hmm. to compensate for that, and so you kind of express the still. You still have the care. You still care about your body, mm-hmm. but now it's your visual information or visual states that are telling you, protect that body part. Mm-hmm. So on the one hand, you know, how are you going to explain this? You know, give this sort of authority of the body story for lepers, but then also, can visual states then become pains because they are playing the function that other, you know, normally whatever mm-hmm. pain system states would be playing?
Yeah, so it's good. I mean, there are a couple of things to say there. So in terms of the visual states, I think it's an interesting question whether you can have these kind of motivationally laden states in the visual modality. There's a lot of interesting debate now about how rich visual phenomenology is. But in general, what I would say, they're certainly not pains, although it might be painful. And that's going to go back to the same question about that you had about your broken arm and sort of what distinguishes these things kind of cross-modally. But I think one, you know, leprosy or Hansen's disease, it's actually a really interesting contrast. So you're with, say, pain asymbolia. So you're quite right that they care about their bodies. They motivated it. What happens is, you know, if people aren't aware of this, in Hansen's disease, you know, there was this traditional idea that lepers, what happened was their fingers fell off from the disease. In fact, what happens is extremities get injured, and because of peripheral neuropathy, they're numb. So the numbness, it's just numbness. So they don't feel anything at all. Because of that, they're very injury prone, and they don't perform this guarding function sufficiently well. So infections set in and you get a lot of bad consequences. Now, in some sense, though, that's a really interesting contrast with asymbolia, because they don't feel pain, but they still care about their bodies. So they do the best they can, trying to substitute visual modality and other sorts of tricks. Whereas pain asymbolia, you know, so there's another story about pain asymbolia that I'm responding to from Nikolai Grahek that says they feel pain, but it's pain is a composite state and they're just missing the motivation that comes from pain. But you might think, well, people with Hansen's disease don't have that motivation at all. But they're still motivated to protect their body. So it's weird that asymbolics don't do this thing where they kind of rely on visual information and so on. So that's the sort of contrast. I think in the case of people who don't feel pain, they are still motivated to protect their body, and they can do it in these other ways, which unfortunately aren't as effective as the way sort of evolution has equipped us with to deal with recuperation and so on. Whereas the striking thing about asymbolia or morphine pain is that you don't do that even though you've got plenty of information and know what would be bad for you and so on.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we're getting close to running out of time, but I do want to get to one of the final chapters, which is on, not surprisingly, the case of masochism or masochistic pleasure. And these, again, are kind of prima facie, very strong objections to an imperativist view, because masochists, you know, by definition, the idea is that you are seeking to act in ways that will not protect your body. So how do you handle masochism?
Yeah, so it's interesting. And I used to have a quicker answer. And then one of the things that this chapter developed out of was thinking about it in a broader sense. So the chapter is actually on, they call masochistic pleasures rather than masochism as such. And this is going to include things like, you know, really enjoying weightlifting or marathon running or hot eating things with lots of hot chilies in them. Or sometimes students will tell me about getting tattoos that they really kind of enjoy the way it hurts. There's also masochism, which is a very contentious and I think probably ultimately very heterogeneous sort of sexual identity. Mm-hmm. So many people who identify as masochists don't actually feel masochistic pleasures. Now, I say the sort of quick defense there as well, and really I take this from a great paper by George Pitcher, the masochist is not just someone with crossed wires who happens to, you know, get pleasure where we would get pain when they, say, get whipped in the backside. It's important to them that it hurts. And so I think when you find, and it's pretty clear when you look at first-person accounts, so the masochist gets whipped. I will use the sexual case because it's, you know, the most fun. They get whipped. They feel what I would take to be the first-order pain. It also hurts, so it's got this second-order, you know, suffering, painfulness component to it. And because they've got both, they actually have to work hard to, you know, stay in the situation and not stop. So they are motivated, I claim, to protect their backside. They've just got an overriding motivation to keep going. And that overriding motivation is there's actually then a third order state of taking pleasure in the hurt. So one of the nice things about treating pleasure, you know, pleasantness and painfulness as higher order sensations is you then get this iterable structure. And so at least structurally, it's possible to have the mental state that say pleasantness qualifies be something like painfulness. Actually, you can get the reverse too, and what I call bittersweet pleasures. So that's the structural story. And then there's a longer story about why you might find painfulness to be a pleasant state to be in certain cases. And there I talk about the story about sort of the thing that most of these things have in common is being on the edge of kind of being too much to bear. And you can link that in with various things like self-control and trust and intimacy, depending on the kind of masochistic pleasure you care about. So that gives the explanation of why it's there. Although, you know, one of the things the chapter does is also spell out further, you know, the puzzles that you can solve when you make this painfulness distinction and then talk about this kind of iterable higher order structure.
Okay. I think we're out of time at this point. Let me just close by asking what sort of projects you're working on now. Are you doing further research into pain, or are you moving to something else? What's next on the horizon for you?
Yeah, well, I've always got a lot of things going on. I do a lot of work on functional brain imaging and kind of methodology and psychology, but I do want to continue working on pain. So one of the things that I'd like to move into is thinking about how a theory like this might apply to something like treating chronic pain. I've said some things in the book about, you know, the problems with really long-term unsatisfiable imperatives and why they might be particularly demoralizing. So I have a young son now, and one of the things I found is there's something about, you know, a kid screaming when they're upset for an hour at you that's uniquely bad. And it's not just the bad of having a loud noise near you. It's this bad of not being able to do something about this insistent demand. So that's a place where I think comparativism can link up. There's also actually a lot of work these days on chronic pain that I think fits well with this pain-painfulness distinction, because as I take it, the argument about things like, say, chronic back pain, what you really get is may even not be very much pain anymore. What you get is the suffering becomes quite intense because you're afraid of causing more pain, or this fear of injury or re-injuring something. And so a lot of the people are starting to realize that the strategies for treating pain and the strategies for treating this kind of long-term suffering should probably be quite different. You certainly shouldn't probably sort of keep shoveling high-grade painkillers at somebody with these kind of chronic conditions, at least as the only thing you do, because that's not really addressing this underlying problem about suffering rather than pain. So where I'd like to take this is really kind of linking up with people who work on chronic pain and other conditions and see if it's a place where we can actually bring philosophy down to do something, you know, tantalizingly close to helping real people.
Right. Have you looked at any work on placebos?
Ah, yes. And placebos, it's maybe we don't have more time. It's a really fascinating topic. And again, that's a place where there appears to be a lot of kind of top-down influence on suffering. Placebo effects are really quite weird, though. There's another place that's really interesting with top-down effects that I've worked with some people at my, or talked with some people at my home institution on, Macquarie University. There's some people doing some good work on hypnosis. And there's actually some fantastic work done on hypnosis as a method of pain control, where they get, you know, they get really quite striking results from it. And again, that's, you know, like placebos, it's intuitively sort of seems very weird that just by talking to somebody in the right way, you could do such strong things.
Cool. So, well, thanks again. I appreciate your taking the time to talk with New Books in Philosophy.
Yeah, thanks a lot for having me, Carrie. This was great.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to my interview with Colin Klein, lecturer in philosophy at Macquarie University in Australia. We've been talking about his new book, What the Body Commands, The Imperative Theory of Pain, which is just out from the MIT Press. I'm Carrie Figdor. This is New Books in Philosophy. I hope you enjoyed the podcast, and thank you for listening.